Hello and welcome to Photo Geek Weekly. This is Don Komarechka, your host, and I am very pleased to be joined by a man who I've never met before, but I've seen around. He has come and poked his head into conversations, and he does some pretty good work as well. Alan Shapiro, how are you doing today,
sir? I'm really good, Don. How are you?
I'm great. I'm now into December, which is my snowflake season. And so that project is all consuming, but still finding time for this podcast, which I really enjoy as an escape to kind of geek out on the photo news for the week. And we actually had some pretty interesting stuff happen this week that came across my radar. But before we get to that, what's new and exciting in your world?
Let's see. I am about to start working on my first color macro book. So I've got a black and white book, I've got a book of portraits, but now I'm going into my Trippin' in the Garden on Miracle-Gro. So I'm really excited about that. It's currently at 700 pages, which is totally unrealistic. So the editing process for me is a ridiculously awful thing.
I hate it. You know, it's funny because I was actually looking to do maybe a limited edition run of just like a book that has all of my snowflakes in it through Blurb or some print on demand company, just to like make one for myself more than anything else. And then I realized that I had almost 1,000 of these things, and that pushes beyond the maximum page limit for pretty much any printer of that sort. And it's like, okay, well, you got to kind of distill things down a little bit and focus. But at that level, when you have 700 pages, it's almost like you don't even know where to start, right?
Yeah, and that's its own interesting challenge, right? Beyond normal editing is now the culling process, and you've got all these favorite children in the orphanage, I'm calling it, because it's not it's beyond an extended family. So
And at a certain point too, you know, like I don't ever delete any photograph, because I did some math a while ago, and it's probably even more true now, that like if it would take me 1 second to delete a photograph and that took up 20 megabytes on a hard drive, if you factor that out with, you know, reasonable break time involved, then like for the cost of like a 4 or 6 terabyte hard drive these days, you'd be working for about $2 an hour just deleting stuff.
So it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So everything just stays, and I just add more hard drives. And so then when it comes time to saying, okay, now let's dig up this water droplet shoot from 2013, because there was this great image in there that I passed earlier. Well, then now I can add that back into the flow, but that's just another one of those children in the orphanage that I now have to find a place for.
Right. So yep. That brings up an interesting question. So are you cloud-based or are you hard drive-based or both? You know, as we talk about storage solutions.
Yeah, I've got a NAS here from Synology, and I still have some open bays in that. It's one of their big 12-bay units. So I think I currently have like available to me around 30 terabytes. I've got about 10 free. And if I start to eat that up, then I can throw in more hard drives. But it's important that that's not like all my eggs are in that one basket, because theft, fire, flood, etc. I would lose it all. I've got a safety deposit box that I keep a 6 terabyte drive that has all of my finished work on it and all of my business documents, you know, for tax purposes and everything. And so that's all there. And I used to, when I had a Drobo, one of the benefits of that was it would be detected as an external hard drive, not a network attached drive. And so services like Carbonite, on their like one or two steps up on their service, would give you unlimited uploads for any external hard drive attached. And so, okay, Carbonite, you want to give me, you know, for like $100 a year, you're going to give me 20 terabytes of storage in the cloud? Okay, you're going to lose on that deal. So yes, please. But as soon as the drive is network attached, which it now is, then that becomes a business class product, and they no longer offer unlimited, and it would cost me like 50 times more the cost to get it up in the cloud there. So that's a challenge. When you have that much data on a network attached drive, getting it all in the cloud is pretty tricky. So I haven't found a perfectly viable solution that won't cost me over $1,000 a month for the amount of data.
Is that because of the upload speeds or just because of the amount of storage you require?
Just because of the amount of storage. The upload speeds, when I was with Carbonite, I had about 12 terabytes or so at the time, and it took me a good 6 to 8 months to get it all.
And for me, that's the ridiculous thing. I want to be able to send a hard drive or multiple hard drives to whoever they are, and I want to say, here, take it, put it up, and be done with it.
Exactly. I had an issue with my internet service provider here in Canada, Rogers. And for the first day or two, the upload speeds were going at my maximum upstream bandwidth, which is around 20 megabits per second, which was fantastic. And then it all of a sudden jumped down to a third of that and hovered at a ceiling of 7 megabits per second, which I thought a little bit odd because that seems like throttling to me. And so I call up Carbonite and they say, no, we absolutely don't do that. I call up Rogers. Not a chance. We would never do that. Okay, well, one of you two are lying. So let's try and figure that out. And I connected into a VPN to Toronto. And so that's maybe about an hour away from me here. And I figured, okay, well, all this is doing is encrypting my traffic so that it can't be seen from my internet service provider. And my bandwidth went up to 11 megabits per second. Now, there's no way that adding a VPN into that scenario would ever increase your speeds. You're adding complexity to the path, and it's going to slow things down. And it slowed it down from what would have been 20 down to 11, but Rogers was throttling the traffic. Or at least that's my assumption. I have not been able to prove it in any other way. Bring this up to their attention, and all of a sudden, my speeds go back to normal. So, huh.
So here's my solution. You go to a Manhattan Starbucks where everyone has turned on their mobile hotspots to, and the power of the collective.
Just kind of the shotgun approach, connect to everything at once. Yeah, I wish that would be effective, but to drag, like this NAS weighs like 50 pounds. I think some red flags would go off if I start bringing that into a Starbucks.
Not in New York. You're in the wrong country.
Oh, well, fair enough. all right. Well, the stories that we have to talk about, kind of, you mentioned something earlier that you've done a macro book in black and white. And I found this really interesting product that sadly, by the time frame that we're looking at here, might never come to be. It's a Kickstarter campaign, and it's called ISOLite. ISOLITE. And this is, in terms of lighting equipment, this is something that I didn't even think would be a thing possible, but it is. Could you imagine, Alan, if you were to take one photograph with three different light sources and then after the fact be able to turn one of the lights off or shape that light after the photograph has been taken and only ever taking a single photo?
Sounds like portrait mode in a new iPhone, Don.
Well, kind of, but you can't like in a studio setup where you're controlling the hair light and you say, you know what, that hair light looks great on the top, but I'd like to take it off on the sides or shape it in a different kind of way. And so they've done it. They have done what at first I'm thinking, this is really gimmicky. I have no idea how this was possible. But if you could imagine, every digital camera is really a black and white sensor that has a color filter array in front of it. And it has red, green, and blue color filters. So if you are able to put a filter over the light source to create such a narrow band wavelength of light that it will only be detectable by the green or the red or the blue filter array, then effectively, once you pull that into a special RAW processor, you can take all of the red pixels, all of the blue pixels and the green pixels, and they are all associated with their own independent light source, process it as such, and then kick it out as a DNG file to be edited like a normal photograph as part of your workflow. Is that cool?
That is beyond cool. I wish they had done a better job of explaining it. You actually did a better job explaining it than what's available on the Kickstarter.
I know. And the problem that I have with that is even from their website, they say, hey, we're on Kickstarter, but you can't actually click the links. You can't get there from here. And so they need to raise $75,000 in an all or nothing Kickstarter. And they are at 18,000 Canadian and only 11 days to go. And so they are probably
not feeling hopeful.
Not feeling hopeful. I don't know if I've got enough listeners on this podcast yet to bump that up, but I'm contemplating putting some money in this pot. And they're based in Toronto. I could even go down and visit them and see this stuff personally. But this has never been done before. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is because we're always hearing about the newest flashes that you know they have greater range or higher color rendering index and what have you. But it's all evolutionary. It's just building on what was there in the past. This is one of the rare things in like photographic inventive thought that is truly unique. I've never seen anything quite like this. you're limited in some ways, of course, because you're separating the color into lighting channels. So you no longer have color. It's going to be a black and white image.
So does it become a luminance-based lighting model, or is it? So explain it to me, because I am not technical.
There are two levels of complication here. Number one is you're black and white only, because one light is effectively going to be a narrow band of green. One is a narrow band of red. One is a narrow band of blue. So what if, like, I am wearing a shirt that has blue and red stripes on it? So if the blue light hits my shirt, then the blue will light up and the red from that light source will be black. And if the red light were to hit my shirt, the opposite would be true. The red lines would be bright and the blue would be black. So it's not as cut and dry and as easy to figure out as one would hope, because depending on the color of somebody's eyes, the color of their hair, the color of their clothing or the background, all of these things will have an impact, like putting a colored filter on a black and white camera and then getting the results back. Yeah, I mean, that would be a creative choice for you to do so. But you would have to be fairly specific and design your image, like what goes in front of the camera, to be relatively monochrome to begin with, to have predictable results.
So do you think this is technology for cleverness sake? Like, let's just innovate. We're going to go into space and we're not sure how to harness that yet. Or is this truly a tool that is going to take photography to the next level?
In like a standard portrait scenario, I think that if you've got a studio setup and you've got these lights, you already know what you're doing for the most part. This is not going to be of any real consequence to you specifically. But let's say you've got some lights strategically positioned in a crowded room, like a wedding reception, and you can then control the way the light falls on people across the room to make one person have beautiful hair light, the bride, for example, in a crowd of other people that you don't want to have that effect on. This could create images that would be impossible otherwise. You'd have to use it in the right way.
So it's a real-time game changer. It's not just the after-the-fact ability, but it is during a crowded event. It's a perfect example.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that scenario, they could target the wedding crowd for this sort of thing, for sure. But is it ready for prime time, was kind of your other side of that thought. And I don't think so. I think that...
Yeah, nor I. Not looking at the Kickstarter, and that's all we have available to us, right? So unless we want to reach out to the manufacturers and say, come on, tell us more because you did a poor job explaining it.
True enough. And I'm not even sure exactly how they're filtering the light down to the specific wavelengths. All of their filters look to be white. So there's got to be something in there that either using optical coatings on top of a transparent surface, or the transmission properties of that glass or whatever it's going to be made of itself. So that there is some behind the scenes. They're holding it, I think, too close to their chest. And people are thinking that this is some voodoo magic. It's not actually going to work for me. And you got to wet people's whistle a little bit. I could read between the lines and figure out a little bit more about it. But if this were to get to a second or third generation product, then it would be on everybody's radar. This is the kind of thing that could be potentially licensed to the big lighting manufacturers. It could be a huge splash, but not in its current state. And if it doesn't succeed, I don't know if we're going to see it progress. I hope so. I hope that the people will kind of put this on the back burner and continue to toil away and maybe take another stab at it in the years to come. I would like to see this come to market.
Anything innovative that's different than the next big processor? Just give me something else. Give me something more interesting than that.
Yeah, not just like, oh, I can shoot at a higher ISO, or, oh, look, more megapixels. That's great. I mean, this is the path that we're always on. And so these innovative things, I think, are quite interesting to talk about. Another one that even if you wanted to get your hands on, you
Lytro.
Probably could never afford, is Lytro. You're excited about Lytro. What's your connection there?
I am. I just think, everything they've done really takes my imagination to a whole other place with what's possible. And so when I look and I consider the world of VR as like the next big frontier, particularly as everyone seems to need to get into content creation and, storytelling of a video format. I mean, this is just phenomenal.
Well, and Lytro had some initial failures in the consumer market. They came out with their little like lipstick camera, and that really didn't sell too well. And then the Lytro Illume, which was an interesting kind of second generation, but it just, the price was too high and it was still a novelty. If it got again to a third generation, then it would really have probably taken off. But they realized, I think, that the money would be made producing higher end equipment for cinema and charging
like, anything they want.
Luxury automobile prices, I'm sure, to produce it. So they've had a number of cinema products. They've just revealed an update to their Emerge, which, if you haven't seen this thing, it is a gigantic hexagon that, if you were to stand next to it, would be at about your forehead height, or taller than you. I'm not sure how tall you are, Alan, but it's massive. This thing is huge, and it has 90 cameras on it, all of them pointed in slightly different directions or in different positions, so that you could do both light field and a now updated to have 120 field of view, degree field of view, that if you can process that properly, and I'm sure there are special software and it's got to be integrated with a 3D workflow and everything, you basically have 360 degrees with extra points of view added in afterwards. For a VR headset to say, okay, well, I'm going to sit in this position and have 6 degrees of motion. So that's left and right. So you'd see a parallax effect. If there's a person standing in front of you, you move left or right, you'd see the background change behind them. The things in the foreground would shift at a different rate than the things in the background. Up and down to the same degree, forward and backward, rotation left and right, and rotation top and bottom. So that's your 6 degrees that you've got in true proper VR. But you know, if you've got like a 360 camera, those are neat and novel, but you have no sense of depth with them. Where in this case, you have not only stereoscopic depth, but you've got like video recorded content. So could you imagine that even like for cinema, this is fantastic. And I would love this for, you know, interactive content, but even for, you know, the US President's State of the Union address, to have that, to feel like you're there in that room, which would make me want to throw something maybe, but that's another story.
Yeah, we're getting political now.
Oh, I don't want to get political. But to the point would be...
But the example that they give with the hallelujah, you know, they recorded a choir, and it's beautiful.
It is. It's beautiful. Even for sports, could you imagine one of these installed at the sidelines of a soccer game? And you would have front row seats in VR to that game from that location, or behind the nets of a hockey game. So there are like vast potentials for this if you could do it live, or if it's just a recorded special event, then you've got the ability to preserve that in a way that can be witnessed by people like you were truly there. And I don't think that anything has approached that to this point. This is not technology we would ever have our hands on, like to be behind a rig like this.
No, this isn't coming to our local camera stores. Absolutely not.
It's not, but the potential is there for this to revolutionize our consumption of high-end media. Could you imagine something like, what if James Cameron got his hand on one of these things, you know, to produce,
or George Lucas,
or George Lucas, or whatever the next.
He doesn't even need it. He just makes it up.
Well, true enough. And now we're annoying other people by these sorts of statements. But if you could put this in a content creator's hand as a tool that has a very big budget, this will change the way we consume media. Right now, VR headsets are a novelty because the content really has not brought us all to the table. I don't own one yet because the current crop of them are only, I think, like 1080p resolution. So full HD, but when it's that close to your eyes, you can kind of, it breaks reality to some degree. Where Lytro is saying now, this technology rolled out at 3.5K per eye. Now it's at 5K per eye. And in the very near future, we can do 10K per eye. And they are light years ahead of the actual hardware that you would use to consume this media, which is fantastic. You know, you look at the cameras from Red that are shooting 8K, and that's great, but 8K TVs don't really exist right now. Neither does the medium to store and play it back. So from many perspectives, like the cutting edge is like in terms of content creation, is far and above beyond what our ability to consume is right now. And that is really exciting.
That's thrilling. That is the best part of this creator society, this renaissance we're going through. The other thing that would be interesting, do you remember when Polaroid took their large format Polaroid camera, the 24-inch, and made it available, right? You'd go up to Cambridge and you'd be able to walk in and rent the studio and the staff. I want that to happen with Lytro, with the Emerge.
Oh yeah. And Lytro, they're the only player in this, to my knowledge. There might be other people that are doing light field technology. I remember there was a German company doing something, but not to this scale at the very least. This gigantic like bug's eye camera setup. Oh man, what if that could fit in my hand? What if? You know, I mean, it's designed on a large scale to give you the 6 degrees of freedom to move around the scene. So you would need it that big for this this kind of scenario. But wishful thinking on my part to ever have this as a tool I could get my hands on.
It's coming, I guess. Would you rather this or a driverless car? Like, you know.
You know what? I don't mind driving.
Okay. So we want this. This is going on your Christmas list.
Yeah, absolutely.
Got it.
Perfect. Okay, so final story, and this is a fun one, a little bit more down to earth in the software world. We now have Capture One 11 that has just been released, and the Capture One software has been grabbing my attention for the last little while because it's been getting really good and really
it
powerful.
It is so good. It's so good, Don. It is the algorithm. It does have a learning curve.
Oh, any software does. So, I mean, if you're using any other piece of software out there, I'm currently a Lightroom user, you've got to sit down and retrain yourself to some degree. And as they add more layers of complexity, then that training takes new curves and new depths. And I get that. I understand that. It's true of anything. But the newer release, they're hitting into areas that I don't think anything else is really diving into. In terms of being able to mock up a photo for editing. And I've seen, what was it? It was Henri Cartier-Bresson, one of his original images that was marked up very, very heavily by the editor for printing. And it was just scribbles. Like that's all it was. And you would have to know the hieroglyphic language to decipher that. But now, just as a layer, you can, if you've got a tablet, you can say, okay, well, this is going off to an editor if you're at an ad agency, and say, okay, these are the changes that need to be made to the image, and then turn the layer off, make the changes, turn it back on if you need any further guidance. That's great. Even simple stuff like the ability to feather a local adjustment brush after you've brushed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and thinking about it computationally, they have to know where you've brushed and apply a feather to it no matter what. I mean, Adobe would probably have to have the same impact as well. So why not let you adjust that after the fact? It seems like it's a relatively easy thing to do. And they've done it. And a lot of other adjustments.
But no one did it before. So they did it.
They did it. And so they're leading in a lot of these areas. There's a few things that I was surprised weren't there. Like, oh, there's now a checkbox to not import suspected duplicates that Lightroom has had since the beginning. It's about time. Thank you. Glad it's there now. But Alan, what's your opinion of the software? I'm assuming by your fawning over it that you use it.
Yeah. In fact, I'm up to version 10 and I downloaded version 11 today. So I upgraded. I haven't had a chance to put it through its paces, but I am really super stoked about it. There is something, there's two parts to it. One, it is the no different than when you go from a DSLR to a medium format. There's something about the quality of the file that is different. And I can tell you, as I've been a Lightroom user since it first came out, I remember Photoshop version 1. So I'm a huge Adobe fan. But when I opened up Capture One for the first time, the image just looked different. So there's an emotional connection. There's something else that's going on for me in particular that I love Adobe, don't get me wrong, but the ability that Capture One did for me to subscribe on a yearly basis or just buy a standalone version. I think it speaks
to
a level,
both options. Yeah.
Right? It speaks to a level of customer understanding, right? Give the community what they're clamoring for as opposed to just pure profit. And I have a lot of respect for companies that at least at the top level acknowledge the community of users that they are, you know, purporting to support.
And if you look back at Adobe, if you wanted the full version of Photoshop when they were on a buy it outright model, I mean, it might cost you up to $1,000, depending on what bells and whistles you wanted on that. And then your upgrade cost afterwards would be multiple hundreds of dollars. But wouldn't it be great if those two coexisted for people that did not want to adapt or had already bought in to the initial price and wanted to pay the upgrade fee on a year-on-year or 18-month or whatever the cycle would be that they upgrade the software? Those are the people that were hurt, I think, the most when Adobe transitioned to the subscription model. I did not have the full Adobe suite at that time because it was like ridiculously expensive to get everything all together. Now for $50 a month, I get everything that they've ever made, and that's fine, I suppose. That's the cost of doing business. But once you, like, if you were to buy into that, then you were kind of kicked to the curb by Adobe. And to have a company come along and say, hey, you know what, we respect that you want to own the software and carry that forward, you know, Don't look at Adobe.
Exactly. Or if nothing else, you know, people say, I want faster processing. Capture One. It's easily, I haven't done speed tests. I'm not the geek, but for me, it feels twice as fast.
And the big selling point of the new version of Lightroom Classic CC, as they're now calling it, is that it's no longer broken. It's now fast again. Like, okay, that's your big selling feature is that it's a bug fix. I can't get behind that as much as I want to. The only reason why I have not jumped from Lightroom over to something like Capture One is I've got a weird workflow where, like, I'll take a bunch of images and I'll send them off to Photoshop as layers within the same document for focus stacking purposes and what have you. If I were to do that in Capture One, I would have to export them all as TIFF files and then load up Bridge and then from Bridge import them all as layers. And that extra step, that extra hiccup is enough to stop me because that's just a lot of wasted time waiting for all those files to download. And then I've got to delete them when I'm done with all of these TIFF files because they're no longer required once I have them put together. No software outside of Lightroom and Bridge has the ability to load things into Photoshop as layers, separate images. The layering that Capture One is doing, that allowing you to import multiple layers back into the file, I know that they're building the underlying framework to make this one little feature that nobody cares about but me.
It's coming.
Put that in there, and I'm all for it.
Yeah.
So cool. So you'll have to let me know what your experience is with the new version. I often try to like dive under the main headlines and see, okay, well, what are those little et cetera miscellaneous things that have been modified within the software? And I'm sure I'll dive into that because this is really becoming the tool that is going to make a big difference for me. So we'll see where that goes. Who knows? Capture 112, you might have me. You might have me sold.
Okay. Well, I think you should, if nothing else, 30-day free trial, download it,
give it a shot.
Right?
Yeah. Maybe it'll be even worth the extra burden that I described to you.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So those are the three main stories that we were going to chat about today. And there was a little bit of side trailing on that. But I always like to ask, now that I'm doing a kind of a co-pilot here, what is the next photograph that you're planning on taking? The next big creative, I know you mentioned the book that you're putting things together, but what idea are you sitting on that is just, you know, burning a hole in your pocket, so to speak, in terms of getting your camera in your hands and, you know, investing a little bit in maybe setting something up to do something staged or to go on location or to do something that pushes your craft further?
I have always been very keen on the overlooked. And I know that seems almost like a trite or cliche kind of thing, but working with homeless or you know, mm-hmm. the underserved society, that has been, you know, it's when I picked up a camera when I first started about, I don't know, it's probably 8 or 9 years ago. Now I was introduced to a group of doctors who were doing a more humanistic approach to critical care and terminal care. And so the ability to create and tell stories visually has taken on a whole other level because there's an empathy spin to it. So I'm actually working with, or I'm wanting to start, and it seems like it's going to happen, start working with terminal patients to tell their stories. And I don't know how that, so for me, that is going to be a very emotionally satisfying and potentially unsettling experience.
Yeah, I could imagine. And I've known some of these people myself. I mean, my father died at an early age at 47, and it was a long-term illness. And so to hear his stories, you know, at the end when he was just fully open and like he's got nothing left to hide at that point. And so that, I mean, helped us bond in a certain way. But in order to document that mentality, I think, where you've got these people that some may have accepted it, some may not have, depending on their age and their scenario and everything. And to assuming that you'd be working with the people that have accepted things. And that want to kind of share their life's worth in a photograph or in a video or in some sort of narrative in any way, shape, or form. Not only do the families, I'm sure, appreciate that. Like my grandparents are getting older, and you know, I love listening to all of their stories. Those stories will disappear at some point. And right now they're all up in here, but can I do something else with them? Can I get them in writing? Can I get just an audio of them? Because that's important.
So yes, for me, context becomes so important. It's very important in everything I do. I like telling the story that went along with the image, whether it's, you know, the real fact-based, the imagined, just the, or the ramblings that comes through as a creative mind looks at something. But so now take a portrait and look at it, and without any backstory, and it's a portrait. But if you knew that this person died a day later, what would happen? Like, does it change? And so there's this interesting thing about the context, about the larger story that is beyond an image. Does it, and why is that so important to me and so not important to others?
Well, I don't think that it's not important to others. I think that the real point that you're trying to hit on there is that people want it to be important. You know, if people were to read that story, they will be impacted by it. It will have the force that you are trying to create. But people generally turn away from it. You know, that they don't want it a part of their personal life because it could be either emotionally scarring or it could be just a weight or a burden. But when you do see it from afar, and it's a portrait of a stranger that died a day later, and you get to hear a bit of their story, you get pulled in at the end rather than not wanting the end to happen. And I think that's a definitive difference there that could make that project quite a fun success for you.
We're going to find out. And how about you? Let me turn it around. What's next for you?
Oh, geez, I'm doing so many things all at once. There is some documentary film work that I can't name names on that is going to be keeping me busy. But I will state that in the past year, I've worked for National Geographic, BBC, and Discovery Channel. There are new things happening in the documentary film world. So that's exciting, sort of behind closed doors at the moment, but, it will go places, I'm sure. I'm gearing up, of course, as I mentioned, for the snowflake season, and we're going to get winter weather coming in within the next couple of days. But I was talking to these guys that make this product called Adaptilux, and it's basically this little control pod that has five little sockets in it to put in little arms that have lights on the end of them. And there's this a tripod or like a camera hot shoe mount on a tripod mount or whatever you want to put it on. And so for macro continuous lighting, you could get little arms that have different colored lights or different colored diffusers. And they've just launched a Kickstarter campaign that has an ultra bright light, a laser light, and an ultraviolet light.
Oh, tell me that name again, because I...
Adaptilux. Adapt, A-L-U-X.
I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds right up my alley. And I know you've been doing a lot of interesting stuff with alternate lights. So
yeah, so the ultraviolet light really piqued my interest. And I was talking to them right before they launched their campaign for this. And I'll be receiving a prototype of their ultraviolet lighting arm. And I think this could be a lot of fun if it's as clean as I hope it is in terms of purely ultraviolet. There are some time-lapse or continuous video projects that I've been toying with that would require a lot of ultraviolet continuous light to make happen. And this product might be the case, or it might be the solution to that. So we'll see. I'm very excited for this sort of stuff, because that ultraviolet genre that I've been playing with for the last year over the summertime mostly got a fair amount of acclaim. It was featured in some international newspapers, and some of the photo blogs picked it up. And it's just really cool to see, you know, a dragonfly's wings glow blue, or, you know, a flower glow in unknown or unseen colors and patterns and things like that. So to have more product coming on the market specifically targeted towards photographers for this obscure genre of work has me excited. When that prototype arrives, I will be putting it through its paces. So that's going to be the next creative thing that I jump onto.
Excellent. Very cool.
Yeah. So, Alan, you mentioned a few of your projects, but as we're wrapping this up, where can people find you online?
Oh, my God. Well, let's see. I'm on Facebook as Alan Shapiro.
One L, right?
One L, A-L-A-N. S-H-A-P-I-R-O. My website is alanshapirophotography.com. I'm on Instagram as alanshapiro515. Happy birthday, May 15th. And Google Plus, if anyone still pays attention over there. And, you know, so.
Yeah, if you go to alanshapiro.com. Hey, I use Google Plus all the time, and I still get a fair amount of commentary and feedback on that. But it is not the network that I hoped it would be.
I know. I feel like I need to have a funeral.
Yeah, well, but it's not going to die. I mean, Google just keeps transforming it and putting more nails in the coffin over time. And then maybe taking a nail out once in a while just to let a breeze run through. But no, it's really where I find my biggest interactions right now on Facebook. Surprisingly, Twitter's been picking up for me.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
So I guess for me, it's more Instagram than Facebook, but you know.
I mean, kind of the same corporate entity, I suppose. And Instagram is big too. I would say Instagram is probably number two, but Twitter was a distant third, and now it's kind of biting on Instagram's ankles.
I'm just waiting to see what's next. I'm sort of hoping that there, you know, we get back to something that's a little bit more discerning.
Yeah.
Or hoped 500px would be that community, but.
And I post there too, and I do get a few comments here and there, but it is not really a community-based environment. You look at the photos that get rated the highest. I mean, it's either going to be a spectacularly overdone landscape or a scantily clad woman.
Or, you know, the GWCs, as we call them, the guys with cameras that are just shooting, you know, pretty girls.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's their hotspot, I guess. But Instagram is talking about rolling out the ability to regram, or whatever you want to call it as a verb, where you'd have the ability to share an image, which is kind of interesting, because if you want to share something on Instagram, you've got to like do a screen capture or download it yourself and then re-upload it to your own account, and that's a big copyright no-no.
Right. Yeah.
So even if you attribute it to the original artist or photographer, it's unless you get explicit permission, it's still not what you should be doing. And it happens all the time. So yeah, it would be great if they add that feature in, because some of my images do get ripped off and not attributed to me. And then this other account gets like 1,000 likes on it. It's like, okay, well, those kind of belong to me. I would really like to have them attributed to me, please. Yeah. Anyhow, that's enough of my complaining for the day.
We could talk about that particular topic for hours, because it's the most annoying thing and it happens daily. So
you look at any of the photo blogs and you will see the next big copyright infringement case happening between some photographer and a big corporation or a celebrity, or, you know, it's we've talked about it previously on this show, and I didn't want to bring it into the conversation today, even though some of them were there. It makes me weep and cry. I'll make a little PSA here at the end of this recording. Take some of your images that have been the most popular and drag them into Google Images, because you can do a reverse image search and see where your images show up online using the image as a search term. And while I can't speak to the exact details, I've got a number of cases in the US and in Canada with lawyers talking back and forth amongst each other to sort this stuff out, because you know somebody stole my work. And if you are not actively looking to find your images being stolen, then they're probably being stolen and nobody's ever going to get paid. So I know at least one company that it's their business model to steal images and then pay for any settlements that come out of the theft rather than license every photograph, because it would cost them more to license every image than it would to pay out the settlements on the very few people that actually call them on it.
That's absurd. Talk about a crazy business model. And you would think that they would, at some point, it would grow into a class action suit and just we could shut them down. But
not going to happen, because not enough people jump on the bandwagon.
So here's my advice. Spend half as much time protecting your images as you do sharing them.
Yeah, no, that's a great strategy. You might need a bottle of wine in hand when you're starting to search for them online and see all the very depressing usages. I do that about once a quarter or so. And you don't have to do it every day, but just once in a while, especially once Google has had a chance to refresh its archives and everything and adjust its algorithms, you'll get different results from one week to the next.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Cool. All right. On that note, Alan, it's been a great chat. For anybody still listening at this point to our rambles, you can find this podcast at photogeekweekly.com. And there is a Patreon link there if you'd like to support us on a weekly basis, which would help cover bandwidth costs, etc. And, you know, if you enjoy this, you know, feel free to submit a story or suggest a co-pilot to sit in Alan's seat in the future. I think next week I've got Sharky James coming up. Who I think we'll have a great chat with.
Oh, he's great.
Oh, he's great. We'll have fun. So Mike will be in the hot seat, and well, hopefully there'll be interesting stories that we can kind of ramble on with. But until then, you've listened to us for long enough, so why don't you pick up your camera and go out and shoot?